Frank Zappa did that song, I Am the Slime Oozing Out from Your TV Set, which is an interesting way to bring out my next guest, David Bianculli, who is the founder of the website TV Worth Watching and a professor at Rowan University in New Jersey. The last time I spoke with David on the air was when he published Dangerously Funny, a book about the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour that became the definitive book about that show. Now he's back with a new one called The Platinum Age of Television, from I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, and I'm sorry my titles and my books keep getting longer.
That's okay. You know, I'm old enough to remember an era when there was no colon in a title of a book. You just had the book. You didn't have to have a subtitle after it.
I know, and now I've got, it may even actually be two subtitles. I think I may have hit some sort of personal record here.
You first coined the phrase, the platinum age of television, in 1992, but in the book you say it didn't actually start till 1999. So why were you premature?
Well, actually, in real life, I was 3 months premature. But in this book, I had to define what it really was. If the golden age of television was the 50s, and, you know, television really got good with live TV and live drama, then when did it change again? And I came up with three possible start points. So you can tell me which one you think is the best. There's 1970 with the start of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and MTM Productions. There's 1980 with the start of Hill Street Blues. And then there's 1999 with the start of The Sopranos and The West Wing. And The West Wing, one of the last great broadcast shows, and The Sopranos, one of the first great cable dramas. And I went with the most recent one.
But does that mean that now is better?
Yes, it does. And I'm an old fart, so it pains me to say that. I'm much more of a get-off-my-lawn kind of guy, and I would love to say, oh, no, they haven't made television since they did it in 1961 with East Side, West Side.
Oh, no.
But it is better now. It is better now. And I love, I mean, I wrote a whole book on the Smothers Brothers, and that was a variety show in the 60s. So I am very aware of excellence that was done in previous decades, but there is an evolution that I am able to catalog and witness, and I hope argue successfully, that makes television better now, both in quantity and quality.
What about the John Landgraf comment that we now have too much television?
Well, I sympathize with him. He's an executive who makes it, and his perspective is that there's too much good television because it's hard for him to get the attention of viewers and critics for the stuff that he makes because there's just too much of it. As a TV critic, I agree that there's too much. It's overwhelming. But I think I'm being really churlish if I complain about that, because in the 70s, I would have begged for too much good TV. So, you know, now that it's finally here, it should be, that's a good problem. That's my problem to have to deal with.
But it's a difficult thing for the viewer to be able to keep up with, because television is no longer being created by just those channels that normally come through your cable or satellite service. Now, because of Amazon Prime Video and Netflix and Hulu and on and on and on, there are a myriad of these streaming companies that are creating things. There, you know, I know your website, TV Worth Watching, gives people tips on what's there, but it's nothing like the days where, okay, the TV Guide is here this week, let's go and see what's there, or what's going on with premiere week in September when the new shows are on. How do you even keep up with it?
Well, you're absolutely right. And first of all, it's hard to keep up with it. And second of all, I would love to say, well, this obviously makes a website like mine so valuable, because in this fractured TV universe, everybody needs to find out what's out there that's really good. Except the universe is so fractured, most people can't even find my website. I'll tell you, I swim in the irony, and it's a riptide.
Yeah, but I get a lot of recommendations from friends. I mean, I probably am aware of more things than most people because of what I do for a living, about what's out there. But I also have a lot of people and a lot of listeners and a lot of readers of my website who tell me about recommendations. If it weren't for them, I wouldn't have found things like, there's a series on Netflix called Marcella that
yes.
If a friend hadn't told me about that, I would never have known that existed.
And look, Netflix all of a sudden in the last few months has decided that it wants to come out with new shows and specials every week now. It's almost like a restaurant, not a streaming service. And it is hard to keep up with all of these, and Acorn TV and Hulu. But whenever I find something that's good enough to share, and to really get excited about, that's what I love most about being a critic. It's not dumping on bad shows. Yeah. That's no fun at all.
Right.
And way too easy. But to steer people towards good stuff is fun.
I know that feeling of having to sit through garbage, and you walk out and you go, oh, you know, whether it's a movie or a TV show, when it's over, you go, oh, I'll never get that time back.
And your job requires you to do what mine. That's why it's a job.
Yeah.
When you know instantly that something's bad, and you've got to keep watching it, that's when it's work.
You know, at the other end of the spectrum, besides all the new stuff that's out there, is so much old stuff that's also available, whether it's on YouTube or through these streaming services, or, you know, Antenna TV and Get TV and Me TV and all these channels that are dedicated to just reruns.
Well, you're good. You actually just named a lot of them. And Cozy TV, yep.
I never heard of that one.
Oh, there you go.
But
I have another one to look up.
I have a specific example for you of why nostalgia, you know, the old line, nostalgia ain't what it used to be. And here's a perfect example.
Yes.
Last year, when they came out with the feature film version of The Man from U.N.C.L.E.,
uh-huh.
I flashed back to my boyhood when I loved that the secret agents and Open Channel D and Robert Vaughn and David mm-hmm. McCallum and Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin and Leo G. Carroll. I mean, I remembered it like it was yesterday. And so I went and I found an old episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and boy, was it bad.
Oh, it's, you know, it's fun to revisit those things from your youth. And
no, it's not. It ruined it for me, David.
Process shots or any of the bad technical things, or and you forgave. You know, I love watching old Mission Impossibles because they go to a different country
yes.
every year without leaving the back lot, and they just change the stop signs to Halton, you know, or something like that. They just, you know, it's just.
Or they're in a white panel truck and it says GAZ on the side because they're from a gas company.
Yes,
Gaz.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is what we talk about. When I talk about the evolution of television, it's one of the ways that it's evolved is that as everyday viewers, we're not settling for less. I mean, our standards are higher, but back then, really, you know, I Spy, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., that was about as good as it got back then.
Yeah.
It's just, thank goodness, it kept getting better.
It ruined it for me. It ruined a childhood memory. Don't go back and watch too many of those things because they'll come back to haunt you. Now, on the other hand, there are shows.
On the other hand, go back to The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. That,
well,
never mind, go ahead.
Stephanie Powers.
Or The Brady Bunch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or you know what? I wanted to ask you about this. The Dick Van Dyke Show is a show that I loved, and I taught my daughter about it, and she loved it. And this Sunday night, CBS is going to air two colorized episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show. What do you think of that?
I don't know what color, you know, Laura Petrie's capri pants are going to be.
That doesn't matter to me as long as they're capris on Harry Tyler Moore.
I've watched the colorized I Love Lucy's that CBS has done lately for the holidays.
Yeah,
they just did one last week, and I'm not as repulsed by them as I thought I would be.
Mm.
But as a purist, I will always stick with the black and white, and I will always show the black and whites. excuse me, to my students, but I understand that the network wants to do. My students have to watch black and white. Other 20-year-olds, they just won't. And so the networks are trying to figure out a way to introduce this old TV to a new audience because there are all those networks you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people aren't going to those. A lot of people, the DVDs are out there in box sets, so you can get The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Nobody's going to that.
Right.
Or a few people. The irony, another irony in which to swim, is that more old TV is out there than ever before, but it isn't being absorbed more than ever before.
Who has time with all the new TV?
Right. There you go. There you go.
All right. In your book, The Platinum Age of Television, you interview a whole bunch of people who created some great TV through the years. Mel Brooks, Carol Burnett, Vince Gilligan, Kevin Spacey, Aaron Sorkin, David E. Kelly, Larry David, David Simon, Ken Burns. But I'm most interested in your encounter with Louis C.K.
Oh, good for you. You have a good taste.
Thank you.
Well, it's just that's the only one in the whole book where I put in a transcript because I thought the back and forth between the two of us was so interesting. So when I say you have good taste, I'm really glad that you liked that because that was sort of a roll of the dice for me. I didn't know if anybody else would care about an artist talking to a critic when halfway through the interview, when I'm talking about, you know, leading up to how much I love his work, and we get to a point where we're going through his work chronologically, and we get to one, you know, before he did Louie on FX, which I think is brilliant, mm-hmm. he did Lucky Louie on HBO, which I didn't like all that much.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I say that to him, he says, oh, you hated it. And he quotes me where I couldn't have quoted me, and then goes off and explains his reaction to my review, and we had a long talk about it. It was great.
Now, were you flattered that he would remember your review, or a little bit worried about what his reaction might be because you were so negative about that show?
Oh, I was. Well, I didn't remember being that negative about it until he quoted from memory that I had basically said something. I'm paraphrasing now, but Louis C.K. could probably tell you directly that I had said something like HBO should show that it has good taste by canceling his show rather than giving it an automatic second season renewal like it's doing with so many other programs.
Yeah.
You know, and he's saying your comment, if HBO follows it, is going to put people out of work right about the Christmas holidays. And he said that he wrote that in an email to me. And I told him I never got it. And he said, well, I never sent it. And then he said the reason is because he realized we were both in the same arena, we both cared about TV deeply, and we should both be happy about caring as much as we did about what we were making and watching. And then because of the lessons that he learned from Lucky Louie, when he went on to do Louie, instead of having a writing staff, he did it himself. He took less money to do it the way he wanted, and he emerged with something brilliant. You know, so he told me that he wouldn't have had Louie if not for Lucky Louie and my reviews and reviews of people like me. I don't necessarily believe that. He probably would have gotten there anyway. But it made for a fascinating, and I'd never talked to him before. That was my first conversation with him.
Mm-hmm. Did that conversation with his very, very good memory of what you had said negatively about his work, did that affect the way you thought when you wrote reviews of anything else after that? Did you think, oh, I wonder how this person's going to take this?
Well, you know, I never considered myself a negative critic. I always thought that if I'm going to say things, I'm going to be constructive about my criticism. But there was not much that was constructive there. And I think I just really didn't like his show, and I took it out on his show. And I feel, you know, a little bad. And I said to him, I said, I hope you feel, you know, better about how much I loved Louie and that you'll, you know. And he goes, no, you're missing the whole point here. It's not that I have to agree or disagree with your opinion, whether you like me or not. It's just it's important that you got, you know, you got to the point in your career where you could give an opinion and it would reach me. And I got in the, you know, I got to the point in my career where I could make things to elicit your opinion.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's really something that I hadn't stopped to think about. So mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for that conversation.
The other takeaway from your conversation with Louis is if you had asked me to guess what was Louis C.K.'s favorite sitcom when he was growing up, I would have listed 100 different shows before I said Good Times.
Isn't it something? And I'll tell you what, I learned so much from doing the interviews with all of these people, because accidentally, when I did the first interview with Mel Brooks, I started with 6 questions that I was going to ask everybody. I was going to call all the people I could and ask them the same 6 questions, sort of like James Lipton.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor at Doubleday said, you're a better writer than that. Do profiles. Do full interviews. And so I went back to Mel Brooks and apologized that I could ask you some more questions. But when I started asking about the programs that influenced him the most, the ones he loved the most as a kid, and for him it was radio, not TV, I didn't say, well, what did you think of, you know, Gunsmoke, or what did you think of Amos and Andy? I just said, what were your favorites? I never suggested to anybody I interviewed, you know, what'd you think of All in the Family? What'd you think of The Twilight Zone? And so every name that came up was from them, mm-hmm. and from their memory, from their heart, from their soul. And so many of them were fascinating. Twilight Zone gets mentioned more than any other show. I wouldn't have guessed that.
And by the way, while we're giving out recommendations for things to watch streaming, the latest version of that, if you will, is Black Mirror, which is on Netflix.
Oh, yes.
Which is an absolutely terrific show. People always ask me, what would you recommend I watch? That's it.
Yes, but you have to also tell them that with a warning. Strap in. If you're going to watch that from the beginning, the first episode from the first season is rough.
Yeah, I actually tell them, don't start with the first episode. Yeah. Watch that one last.
Wow, that's actually good advice. That's actually good advice.
Thank you. Yes. Before I let you go here, David, we started off here and you were mentioning some of the landmarks in television, and you mentioned two of them, The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Hill Street Blues. Both of them came under the heading of TV that was developed by a man named Grant Tinker.
Oh, yeah.
Who we just lost last week. Give me a few thoughts about the legacy of this man.
You know, it's so coincidental that you ask me this question, because on today's Fresh Air, I'm the TV critic for that,
yep.
for that program.
Mm-hmm.
I did a tribute to Grant Tinker.
Ah.
And it's a little late, but he changed television for the better more than any other TV executive in history, and a production head in history too. He, as in both hats, he did better by just identifying the most talented people and then protecting them and letting them do their best work.
And by the way, for more than two decades, two different companies created some of the best television of that era, which I would include in the platinum age of television, even though you say it starts in 99. I think we could expand it to include all of that.
Well, the thing is that I say that the platinum age begins in 99, but if you're looking at the evolution of it, because really the book is not just covering TV from 99, it's the whole history of television, and it's like, where did quality come from? And you say, okay, go back to 1970, go back to Grant Tinker and MTM Enterprises and yep. all of those shows, and then how the Mary Tyler Moore Show as a comedy leads to Lou Grant as a comedy-drama hybrid, which leads to everything, you know, from Breaking Bad to The Sopranos. Any type of quality TV show you see today in terms of drama has comedy elements in it that it didn't have before Lou Grant.
The book is called The Platinum Age of Television. In it, I should mention that David also breaks things down and lists the five most influential shows in a whole bunch of categories, from children's programs to animation to sitcoms to crime to dramas to soap operas to medical shows to late night shows and on and on and on. It's quite a read. The Platinum Age of Television, from I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific. David Bianculli's website is TV Worth Watching, and thank you today for being radio worth listening to.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Two books in a row, you should get some sort of an award.
Well, thank you. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.